Thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our show today is about lasers, how they were invented 52 years ago, and how laser technology has become a very big part of our lives today. We are very honored and privileged that our guest today is the distinguished scientist and inventor, Professor Robert Beyer. Professor Beyer has invented many types of lasers, and he holds more than 50 patents. Professor Robert Beyer teaches applied physics at Stanford University. He is also the co-director of Stanford's Photonics Research Center. In today's interview, Professor Beyer will discuss how he started working on lasers and how the laser technology has changed over the past half century. He will also share with us some of the exciting new projects that he and the Beyer Group at Stanford are working on to develop exciting new applications for laser technology. For example, Professor Beyer will describe his ongoing research about how to use lasers to measure gravitational waves. He will also share with us the exciting new research he is working on to develop new kinds of lasers that will help with breath analysis and how those lasers will assist physicians diagnose different diseases. Throughout his career, Professor Beyer has published more than 500 scientific research papers, and he has been affiliated with several scientific societies, including the American Physical Society. While on sabbatical this year, Professor Beyer has been acting president of the American Physical Society, and in today's interview, he shares with us some of the accomplishments of the American Physical Society, as well as some of their future plans. During today's interview, we will also talk to Professor Beyer about Stanford's Photonics Research Center, which he co-directs, and we will also talk to him about his favorite patents and his favorite hobbies. My first question was, why did Professor Beyer decide to study lasers?
I didn't choose to study lasers. I chose to become an astronomer. But when I was in high school in Pasadena, California, I had an opportunity to meet with a professor at Caltech who was a very famous astronomer, Horace Babcock. So I walked into his office as a young senior and knowing I'm going to go to college next year. So I asked Professor Babcock, I want to become an astronomer. Where should I go? And his answer to me was, no, you don't, young man. I'll never forget those words, no, you don't, young man. And so I asked him, what did he mean? And he said, well, you really should go off and major in physics first. And after you study physics and know a broader range of science, then you can make a decision to become an astronomer. So I followed his advice. I went to Berkeley and I studied physics. And during the time I was at Berkeley, the laser was invented. 1960 to 64, I was an undergraduate. 1960, the laser was invented 52 years ago now. And I never heard about it in my class. Nobody talked about lasers. But when I graduated, the professor I had worked with for a number of years in the lab, Professor Sumner P. Davis, told me that there might be a job opening in a small company in Mountain View, California. So I went down and interviewed. And the day that I interviewed was the day that they had made an important invention, a new kind of laser. And they were yelling and screaming and jumping up and down and didn't even know I was in the lobby waiting to see them and finally came out and said, oh, you must be this young kid from Berkeley looking for a job. Come on in, we'll show you the first visible laser. And I was hooked. I mean, that people, grown-ups, could get so excited about discovering a new laser. I said, okay, that's for me. So I had to call my fiance, who lived in Pasadena still, and say, look, I'm going to stay up here for work next year. Why don't you finish your senior year at Berkeley and not at UCLA? So my wife has never forgiven me for that. She liked UCLA. That got me started in lasers because I worked for the first commercial laser company. It was called Spectrophysics in Mountain View. And I worked for them for a year. It was really important to my career because it taught me about how hard it was to take a science idea in a lab and translate it into a product that would work in anybody else's lab without having to be minded every day by PhD students. So that year was quite an eventful year. In 1964, a lot of new lasers were invented. New ideas came about. The field was right on the cusp of its growth.
Next, Professor Robert Beyer will describe how he came to study at Stanford University. He will tell us who his mentors were and how much he encourages young students to have mentors.
At Spectrophysics, I worked with an inventor called Earl Bell. Earl was at Varian Associates before he started Spectrophysics with the other four founders of the company. But Earl, as an inventor, was always thinking about new ideas, and so he taught me how to become an inventor. But he had the statement, once a laser is 5% efficient, it could do real work. And by that he meant that you then have enough optical power that you can affect matter. You can drill holes in matter, you can ablate matter, you can do a laser eraser. All the kinds of applications that a laser would be good at become possible if the laser is efficient enough. And this was at a time when the laser was very inefficient. We were taking kilowatts of power out of the wall plug and generating less than watts of power from the laser. So they were great big heat sources. Later at Spectrophysics, I learned that a professor at Stanford was holding brown bag lunch seminars at Wednesday at noon. And so I asked the president of Spectrophysics, Herb DeWitt, could I go up to Stanford and attend these brown bag lunches just to learn what's going on in lasers? And he said, sure, as long as you make up the time later in the day. I said, that's fine. So I'd ride my bicycle from Mountain View up here to go to Tony Siegman's Wednesday seminars. It was an eye-opener for me because there were new things going on in lasers that I had no idea about. And I could, as a guest, sit there and just listen to his graduate students describe the literature they had been reading and the discoveries that are being made on a daily basis at that time. And that changed my career path, that maybe I should apply for graduate school and see if I could go on to a PhD degree. And so I did. I applied to Stanford and other places and was very fortunate to get accepted to Stanford. And Tony Siegman, I think, had a crucial role in that. He assigned me to a young assistant professor in electrical engineering department called Stephen E. Harris. So Steve just recently retired from Stanford. And it was, again, a little bit of luck because the assignment was perfect. It got me involved in lasers and in nonlinear optics, which has been my field now since that time. How do we change the color of lasers and how do we tune the lasers to do new kinds of measurements that can't be done with the laser at its frequency? I mention this story to my students because mentors are important in your career. So when you're at Stanford, if you're an undergraduate student, take time to sit down and talk to your professor and find out what gets them excited, what they're interested in, tell them about what you'd like to do, and find ways to have that conversation. It's really important. When I was freshman advisor for a number of years, I used to make sure that the one thing that my freshmen did during their first quarter at Stanford was to meet face-to-face with a faculty member. It's really hard to do that because you're uncertain, you're a freshman, you're thrown into this new institution, you don't quite know anybody yet. But more often than not, when they would come back from that meeting, they would come back just smiling. That it had changed the way they think about that course, about that subject, about what they might want to study.
My next question was, did the undergraduate students of engineering at Stanford have the luxury of spending a lot of time in the lab to figure out what their interests were and what fields of technology they wanted to study?
We distinguish between undergraduates and graduate students, and that's natural. And so more often now than in the past, we find projects for undergraduates to work in our labs. In our lab, we have a number of undergraduates here over the summertime, and they work hand in glove with graduate students to get an idea about research, about discovery. Why is it exciting to do something for the first time? And the record that we know now is that if undergraduate students participate in a research program during their undergraduate years, they're much more likely to apply for graduate school, get an advanced degree. For graduate students, it's often very different. Graduate students are already self-motivated. They want to study a particular area. They've applied to a number of universities to try to match their interests to the university's teaching offerings and to match their interests to faculty members they've already pre-identified. So they're here to understand the best that they can about the science or the engineering they're going to study.
You're listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our show today is about laser technology, and our guest, Professor Robert Beyer, has invented many types of lasers. Professor Beyer teaches applied physics at Stanford University, and this year he is acting president of the American Physical Society. In the next section, Professor Beyer will tell us about what the American Physical Society does and its plans to involve more people in studying physics and engineering.
There are 50,000 members in the American Physical Society. It's not the largest physical society in the world. That belongs to the German Physical Society because they involve teachers and industrial physicists in their society. American Physical Society is largely academic physicists, and we're working to change that as well in our future strategic plan. It's an honor to be elected to serve in the leadership of the society, and it comes with responsibility, which we undertake as best we can. So I will complete my year as president of the American Physical Society in January, 4 weeks away. And then I hand it off to Michael Turner, a professor at Chicago University, who is a PhD graduate student in physics at Stanford, so there's a Stanford connection. And then following his service for a year, it'll be Mac Beasley, professor of applied physics at Stanford, that will serve as the president of the American Physical Society. So there's a strong Stanford presence in the society. This last year, one of the highlights was meeting with Pat Burkett, who's a professor of physics at Stanford. And Pat helped to pull together a meeting of young women in physics across the country. And they did it using modern communication technology. So there was a group of 300 young ladies that were physicists met at Stanford. In Southwest in Texas was a meeting and some other universities in the East. And they had one coordinated seminar with all the women attending the seminar. And the featured speaker for that event was Persis Drell, the director of SLAC. Why did we do this? Why was it done? It was done because often women feel isolated when they're studying engineering or physics because they're not yet critical mass in their university. There might be a few women, but not enough to feel that they're a critical mass. And a lot of the comments of the young women, these are undergraduate women as well, that came out of this say, wow, this is really important for me. I'm not alone in studying physics. There are hundreds of women like me that are working to understand physics and contribute to it. So it's a nice way that a professional society can be of assistance in a social era as well as into a scientific venture. That is, how do we involve in physics and in engineering physics and engineering, how do we involve the broader society? How do we involve a representative number of people, both women and men, but also of various different ethnic groups to take part in the physics enterprise? So that's another part of our goals over the next 5 years.
How did the American Physical Society involve undergraduate students and encourage the participation of graduate students and postgraduate students as well?
We have a program called the SPS, Student Physics Chapters, and those undergraduate organizations are across the physics departments in the U.S. And so the American Physical Society helps to support the SPS program. We just completed this year a study for a strategic planning process. We spent a year doing strategic planning. Where are we going to go in the next 5 years? And in the next 5 years, we're working on creating similar kinds of student chapters for graduate students, for postdocs, and for early career physicists. So that's a big thrust for the American Physical Society. That's sort of the forgotten piece of the career that we haven't served well. And now we're trying to make sure that we provide the kind of services, meetings, information about job opportunities to those students that are making the transition from graduate student through the postdoc, if they take a postdoc, into their first job.
I asked Professor Robert Beyer to describe how the society is involved in shaping public policy in Washington.
We have a presence in Washington, D.C., because that's where a lot of public policy is made. Not only in the United States, but it also then spreads across the world. A number of other societies also have offices in Washington, D.C. The Chemical Society, which is larger than the Physical Society, is also there. The Optical Society of America is there. And their reason is they want to be present where these decisions are made. And the decisions might have a component of science in the public policy decision area. Global warming is one of those where science is playing a crucial role. And we need to understand this very complicated sphere we live on called the Earth. We know it's complicated, but we also know that we've been doing an unintended experiment for the last 200 years of industrialization. We've been burning coal and carbon and creating atmospheric disturbances that are leading to weather change. That's evident now. Most scientists would now agree that the human contribution of global warming is now evident. We can see it, we can measure it. That's controversial, but I'll say I believe that now after looking at the data for the last 30 years. There's a book by Stephen Snyder, who died a couple years ago, but he was at Stanford and he did climate change work. And the book is Science as a Contact Sport, worth reading. Stephen took the lead in global climate modeling and spent a lot of his life trying to convince the world that we had to take global climate change seriously. It wasn't going to go away. So the subtitle of this is Inside the Battle to Save the Earth's Climate. I don't like the word save, but nonetheless, it's to understand and make the changes that we need to make so that the Earth can remain a habitable zone for all of us.
Many of the lasers used in remote sensing were invented by Professor Beyer. In the next section, Professor Beyer will describe how remote sensing is used to measure climate change.
I'm not an expert in climate change. I'm an expert in lasers and optics. And we use lasers to do remote sensing of molecules in the atmosphere. And we use lasers to measure remotely the temperature of the atmosphere. So we can do measurements with the tools that I've worked with my professional career and contribute to the understanding of the global climate. It's a complicated system involving the earth, the water, the air, in what I call a coupled nonlinear system, that is hydrodynamic systems that we don't fully understand how they work. And they couple together, so it makes life much more difficult for a scientist to try to figure out what's going on. And we can't experiment easily. We can't change something and see what the response is, right? But we do it indirectly.
How have the improvements in laser technology changed remote sensing over the past 30 years or so?
When we first got started in the early 1970s, there were no lasers that could tune their frequency to look directly at a particular molecule. The lasers were all fixed in frequency, and you were lucky they might intercept a molecule. But in the early 70s, we learned how to build lasers that were tunable, that we could tune their frequency. And the first application that we investigated was transmitting the laser beam through the atmosphere and measuring methane in the atmosphere. We did that across the bay. We measured carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, SO2. We measured water vapor. We measured temperature, all using the tunable laser as our sensor. And the remote distance was 4 kilometers across the bay and back. That laid the groundwork for the application of lasers more broadly in remote sensing. Out of that came an invention called the quantaray laser, which was a neat invention. It was a better way to build a high-power laser needed for remote sensing. And that's the laser that was built by a small company in Mountain View called Quantaray. And then when that company first introduced their product, my best guess at the time was there would be no more than 75 such lasers sold in the world. I couldn't imagine any more than that because that would fill every lab I knew about. So about 1995, this is now 20 years later, I asked the president of the company then, I said, how many of these lasers have you sold? By the way, could you check for me? And he did. And at that time, they'd already sold more than 10,000 of these lasers. So where did they all go is the question. And it turned out a great many of them went into remote sensing. So many of the quantaray lasers found their way to the Antarctica. They found their way to the Arctic. They were doing remote sensing all over Europe. They were doing remote sensing in Asia. So these lasers had propagated and found a natural application in doing atmospheric sensing with a laser source. That still goes on today. They're still being used today. And then finally, a version of that laser was flown in a satellite. And then looking down from above, and did remote sensing from a satellite platform. And that work continues today as well. And they found quite by accident, actually, in a little bit of work, that they could not only look at the atmospheric properties going down, but they could measure the amount of plant life on the planet, because the laser beam would go down through the leaves of trees and then hit the ground and come back out. So you could actually see where the treetops were and where the ground was. And then you could measure the density of the forests on the globe and begin to get a better understanding of that aspect.
So has all this data about climate change that we collect from different satellites been assimilated and published?
Oh, yes, it's been assimilated and published. we're tracking now the changes on the Earth much better than we have in the past because we have many satellite platforms that allow us to do that. We now know the ocean has actually been rising, and it's now becoming evident for those of us who live near shorelines that we're losing sandy beaches on the East Coast, we're losing sandy beaches on the West Coast, we're losing them on all the islands in Hawaii. Why is that? That's because the ocean has risen about 6 inches over the last 150 years, and it's projected to rise over a foot in the next 50 years. That will flood a lot of the areas around the globe that are right at sea level where there's a lot of population base. So we're facing some pretty serious consequences of ocean rising. So making measurements precisely helps us to understand what that is. And the sort of the hallmark measurement that's been the most precise measurement done for the last 50 years is the measurement of carbon dioxide from Hawaiian Islands out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And this beautiful curve where just step by step by step, carbon dioxide is increasing in our atmosphere. So the question that we ask often is carbon dioxide causing the warming or is carbon dioxide an indicator of the warming? And from the paleo climate record, which is now much better understood than it was 20 years ago, we now just have enough information to know that carbon dioxide is the following indicator. It's the indicator of warming, not the driver, not the sole driver. That's good to know in some sense. It says, yes, the increase in carbon dioxide as measured in Hawaii over many, many decades is an indicator of global warming. There's no denying that. That's happening. Now, the question that's always debated in the press is, are humans causing it or is it caused by nature? And it turns out that nature is causing a good part of it because of the way that we get the solar radiation and the planet behaves, but humans have some contribution. There's no doubt that in this century, we're really driven by scientific discoveries as in the last century. More in biology and medicine now, perhaps, than in the past, less in physics. But nonetheless, our understanding of the world and details of the world are scientific issues, and they lead to public policy questions.
I asked Professor Robert Beyer to give us an example of a recent study by the American Physical Society in which they tried to influence the decision makers in Washington, D.C.
Recently, in the American Physical Society, we did a study called Energy Critical Elements. What does that mean? It means that in the modern world, with computers, with electronics, with optical communication, there is a set of elements that we need that absolutely must have access to in order to make the devices that allow us to do these wonderful things. And those are critical elements because there's not a lot of that element on the planet. There's a finite amount. Common ones that you would think about, gallium arsenide is used in a whole set of electronics. The gallium turns out to be a critical element. There's not as much of it on the planet as we would like. We use rare earth elements, neodymium, to make magnets that go in electric cars. And it turns out neodymium mainly comes from mines in China. And there's not as much of that on the planet as we would like. There are rare earth mines in Africa, the rare earth mines in California. And they have not opened up and begun mining again because the Chinese have mined efficiently enough that they've kept the price low. It was only recently that China raised the price of rare earths in a big jump that caused people to reevaluate whether we should open up other sources of mines for rare earths. I think the point being made in critical elements is, as a global society today, we have to pay attention to how our future is going to evolve. And if we identify and pre-identify areas where we have to pay particular attention because that element or that source of resources is limited, we will. But we need to call attention to it. So this study, Energy Critical Elements, was a way to let our policymakers know that there are parts of our life that depend on these elements. So we need to take care. We need to recycle when we can. We need to use them wisely. We can't waste them. And that's where helium gas comes in. Helium gas is a pretty rare gas. It comes from oil wells deep underground. There are very few places where we can bring the helium gas out of the natural gas or the oil. But when we can, we need to save it because once it goes away. We can't replace it. So that's another element. And we often don't get much traction on helium because most people think of it as party balloons, right? I just fill my party balloon. I don't care about helium. But in fact, if we're going to use superconductivity to transmit power, we need helium or liquid nitrogen, but sometimes helium. And there are a lot of other scientific applications where helium is essential. So paying attention to it early means we can save that resource and not overspend it or not willfully waste it.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our first PSA today is about Children's Health Fund. Co-founded by singer-songwriter Paul Simon, Children's Health Fund is committed to providing health care to the nation's most medically underserved children. The organization supports a national network of pediatric programs in some of our most disadvantaged rural and urban communities and advocates for ensured access to medical care for all children. If you'd like to get involved or make a donation, go to www.childrenshealthfund.org. Today's show is about laser technology. Our guest, Professor Robert Beyer, teaches applied physics at Stanford University. He holds more than 50 patents and has invented many types of lasers. Professor Beyer has also worked in industry, and he has been on the board of many companies as well. I asked Professor Beyer about teaching entrepreneurship and whether it's important to teach entrepreneurship to engineering students.
I don't teach an entrepreneurship course. I never have, but I use the opportunity when we teach to talk to our students about entrepreneurial activities and patents and licensing patents and the rest, because those are parts of a knowledge space that scientists and engineers should know. Stanford has been, from its very founding, a university that supports entrepreneurship and supports interaction with business. Senator Stanford, when he established the university, said that we must educate men and women in the West to help build the economy of this region. So it's in our being, it's in our soul at the university that we have this interaction, and that's a positive thing to have. And so the question became, how do we do that and keep the values of the university where they need to be? How can we remain a public institution? We are a private research and teaching university, but we are really public in the sense that we work with government funds, we do research under government support, we educate students from around the world. How can we manage the university and keep it functioning well, transparent to all that come to the university, and still work with companies? And we faced that discussion in spades in the early 1990s when we were learning how to license technologies from universities to the world. And it started with an act called Bayh-Dole Act, and we learned how to respond and how to work with companies in a way that kept us isolated so that we could do what we do, teach the next generation, but contributing to the entrepreneurial activities in the area. And there's a set of policy guidelines that were prepared by Stanford at that time, and it's interesting, they're still on the books. A number of them came out of the Dean of Research office when I was in that office, and so it's fun to see that they still are being used. They were written well enough and thought well enough by the academic senate at the time that they still function well. So we have a series of policies that guide our interaction with industry. And in my mind, they are all predicated that our number one job here at Stanford is to educate students. And if you keep the student welfare in mind when you write the policy, then it's not too hard to write it correctly so it gets the right outcome. And that's what we're aiming for.
My next question was approximately how many of Stanford's engineering students are interested in becoming entrepreneurs?
It turns out students that come to Stanford self-select for entrepreneurial activities. If you have a class meet at Stanford and you ask the simple question, how many of you, when you graduate from Stanford, want to go out and start a company? You ask that question at Stanford, about 15% of the hands will go up. If you ask that question at any other university, let's say Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, zero hands will go up. There's no thought about the idea in those environments that I should go out and start a company. That's not what brought me to that university. Other things brought me there, but not that. this place, because of its connection with Silicon Valley, is a magnet for bringing students that think that maybe I want to go start my company when I graduate. And in my experience, it changes the nature of our teaching. It changes the flavor of a class when you have students in the class that are thinking, I'm going to go become a CEO of a company. I need to know this, and I need to know it well. I have to ask questions because I don't know what I'm going to miss. And so the class becomes a lot more interactive and a lot more engaged in understanding what's going on, because those that know they want to become an entrepreneur are preparing for the time when they have to step out on their own and solve unknown problems and solve them quickly and try to solve them.
I asked Professor Beyer if he would have been one of the 15% to raise their hand when asked if they were interested in entrepreneurship.
I had come from a small company, and so I already had enough familiarity with working in a small startup that to me it was not a frightening thing. It was a fun thing. It was a great challenge. So yes, the answer would have been I would have raised my hand, and later I started some companies because we had some technology and we had ideas of how that could be applied that might lead to a successful company. But they're risky. I mean, the thing you learn about startup companies is only about 1 in 10 really make it. Huge companies like Google are very, very rare. But a lot of companies do okay. And then about 5 out of 10 startups never make it. A lot of those go into what we call the living death mode. They make just enough money to stay alive, but never quite enough to grow. And then some, of course, go bankrupt and die and no longer exist.
Next, Professor Beyer, who holds more than 50 patents, will discuss why it's important to write patents and how he uses patents as a teaching tool.
Earl Bell, I already mentioned, and so Earl was the one that taught me that if you're an inventor and you think of new ideas, then one next step is to write a patent to support that idea. And so when I arrived at Stanford, the Office of Technology and Licensing had just begun to be thought about, and in 1969, I think, is when it finally opened its door in a small trailer across campus near Encino Hall, literally in a trailer in the parking lot of Encino Hall. So I remember going over and meeting with Niels Reimers, the director, and I said, yeah, I have this idea of how to build a tunable laser. I'd like to patent it. He says, oh, sure, come on in, let's work. So we identified a patent attorney and went through the process of writing the patent and having it successfully issued. So it's the first patent on my patent list. But I learned a really important lesson. We'd made a mistake. We'd written some phrases in that patent that had limited the patent to a very narrow region. It only applied to a narrow version of what we had done, not a broad version. So a good learning curve. Good to learn it on early patents, because then you write better patents as you go along. Niels Reimers started OTL with the idea that we should market our technology and get it out into the real world so it does some good, not protect it with lawyers. So he had no lawyers, no legal on his patent. And later on, when Kathy Koo took over OTL, she affirmed that, and our patent office became really the model for many around the country on how to structure an office that would license patents, market the patents, do the negotiation with men and women who were experts in their field, not legal experts. They knew the technology, they knew the science, they knew the people, and they would do the marketing of the patents. And we were quite fortunate that we had someone that became globally well-known for marketing Stanford's patents in lasers. His name was John Sandilan, so he worked at OTL. It didn't take him long before our colleagues in Europe knew about John Sandilan, our colleagues in Japan knew about Sandilan. Companies in both places would come and talk to us about new ideas in lasers, and John would help to negotiate the agreements. All of this was in the framework of building relationships. Our goal wasn't to make money on the patents, which is a crazy idea. Our goal was to make sure that ideas got picked up and maybe got turned into products, which gave public benefit. The money from patent royalties is what I call an honesty fee. You're not trying to get rich off of patents. What you want to do is build a lasting relationship that continues to allow the technology to evolve. If you want to make money, then you'd get to know the president of the company that's successful and ask them to give a gift back to the university to support further research and further development. And that's where the real funds come in. But I use patents today as a teaching tool. So we ask our students in the class, read a patent for me. tell me what the claims of the patent say. Patent language is a completely different foreign language, and you have to learn to read it. And once you learn to read it, then it begins to make a little sense. And so just about the time the students think they've really understood how this patent is written and what the claims say, then I'll turn the question around and say, okay, suppose you're an engineer in another company, you have to get around this patent. Now what does the claim read like? Read it in the other way. And then there becomes a nice discussion in class about how you really interpret what's been written. And what does it mean for you to try to work your way around the patent as opposed to pay the royalties of the patent and use it? So it's all part of a learning curve. And in some sense, a patent is a special kind of publication. That's what it really is. It's a monopoly to the inventors for some period of time to try to get an idea into the commercial market. My favorite patent never made a nickel for Stanford, and it's the green laser pointer. So the green laser pointer is my favorite patent because it was precipitated by a question in class. Most people think, oh, you're an inventor, you have to be back in your office thinking about this. No, I'm teaching a class. And Jeff Dixon is a student in the class, and he and Tom Kane asked me the question, you know, Professor Beyer, if you have a diode pump solid state laser, can you frequency double it to the green? If you can, you can make a small little green laser. And I said, you know, I don't know the answer to that question right now in class, but I'll do my homework over the weekend. You guys do the calculations. Let's compare notes next Tuesday morning. And we compared notes on a Tuesday morning to figure out, yeah, we could actually take a little laser pumped with a diode and put a crystal inside the laser cavity and make green. And we did the experiment a few weeks later and wrote up a patent. And the patent was issued in 86. It matured in 2006. And about the year it matured was the year that the green laser pointer took off as a very widely used laser around the world for lectures and talks and pointing at stars and rescuing sailors at sea. There's a whole set of applications for this very small, compact green laser pointer. But it's a patent that never brought any money to Stanford because it matured before the market took off.
I asked Professor Beyer about technology transfer and if it's possible to create a Silicon Valley in some other country.
Technology transfer is an interesting game. We often used to characterize it as a body contact sport. It's not something where you hand a publication to somebody and say, I've transferred technology. It's not something where you give a person a patent and say, read it, and I've transferred technology. Technology lives here, lives in your brain. You have to understand all the details surrounding it, how it fits, what it can do in the future, where it can go, where it's come from. So that's people. And so really when you transfer technology, you're actually having people move from one place to another and take with them their knowledge and how to apply that knowledge. So when you understand that, then it becomes a little easier to see how Silicon Valley-like economies can be built. You need a place where you attract intelligent people that are educated and want to stay in the region, and if they're going to stay in the region, they have to create a job somehow. And so they transfer knowledge to a region, and that region then can build on its strengths and become an important economic engine. So in the early 1990s, when we were worried about technology transfer and writing, quote, the policy rules for it, the question would occur, would we ever see a Silicon Valley somewhere else in the world? Good question, valid question. Because we weren't clear if other parts of the world had all the ingredients that go into making Silicon Valley successful. Ingredients are, is there land available? Are there education institutes nearby? Is there money to be invested? Is there a free economy where people take risk? Are there lawyers? Because you need legal help to set up companies and operate them. You need all of these elements. And if you have all the elements, then you can see a takeoff point and see it work. After I served as dean of research, I would get invitations to come and give talks in parts of the world about Stanford and its relation to Silicon Valley and how the policies that we developed were working. And every time I would go, I would pay attention to that region of the world and how it would be evolving. So the first place was Hsinchu, Taiwan, and they became one of the first examples of Silicon Valley being established in another country. And following that, I was in Munich, I was in southern France, Norway, other parts of the U.S., Canada 3 times. And every time I went to one of these places and gave a talk on Stanford and Silicon Valley, you'd see that they were thinking about how to establish and build a technology component to their local economy. And the latest one that was a lot of fun was Barcelona, Spain. because there was a strong local community, 2,000-year-old Catalan community, that wanted nothing to do with this modern economy. They had their old economy that they'd worked with for thousands of years. But today, there is an industrial park in the south of Barcelona. It's bustling. It's got small startup companies. It's technology-oriented. So they had established the capability to do what we do in Silicon Valley on a Barcelona scale in the local economy and the local environment. So the answer now is unequivocally yes, Silicon Valley as an economic phenomena can be transported and established in many places around the world, and it has been.
In addition to being an inventor and teaching applied physics at Stanford University, Professor Beyer is also the co-director of the very prestigious Stanford Photonics Research Center. Next, Professor Beyer will discuss why Stanford Photonics Research Center is so important.
We have a Stanford Photonics Research Center. For many years, we've had affiliates programs at Stanford, corporate affiliates programs, and they were first established in the mid-1950s. Aero and Astro Department created the first sort of university corporate affiliates program to bring the aerospace industry to Stanford and do joint work. In 1961-62, John Linville and EE established a solid-state affiliates program based on the idea that semiconductors were becoming important in the economy. And Stanford was doing research on semiconductors, and we needed to work with companies in the local area. So Stanford now has more than 40 affiliates programs involving hundreds of companies on campus across many disciplines. So again, it's one more way we facilitate communication with the outside world in a way that makes sense. So why would companies spend some of their time and money to join these affiliates programs? Almost always it's for two main reasons. One is get some access to what's new in the knowledge base in the field, some idea of the upfront of what's new and what's evolving. But the really important one is to get access to students. I want to know who the young students are. I want to know how they're doing. I want to know if I can meet them during their career as a PhD student. I want to hire them when they graduate. And for us, what we get is we get a set of resources to help us, again, teach the classes that we teach, support the classes, and sometimes support research. In addition to government support, we get some corporate support to help our basic research move forward. So it's a nice connection, and the SPRC is part of that connection. We have an outward-looking program that brings companies to campus once a year. We have an annual meeting in September. And we have an inward-looking communication program to help communicate across the multiple departments that use lasers and photonics in their research. It's in medicine, it's in biology, it's in neurology, it's in mechanical engineering, aero and astro, EE, physics, applied physics, I mean, chemistry, chemical engineering. All of these departments today use the tools called lasers to do their forefront research. And it's those tools that Stanford Photonics Research Center advertises, talks about, explains, and that's why people come from around the world to attend this meeting every September. And on many people's list, it's the number one meeting they're going to attend. If I have to go to one meeting a year, I go to SPRC at Stanford because I get the right mix of what's new in the world in photonics, the best and brightest students giving talks, representatives from companies giving talks from the major leading companies in the area all together for a three-day period. And Tom Baer is our leader of this group, the executive director, and he does just a marvelous job of creating this sense of welcome to Stanford, and let's both have fun but work hard for a few days.
In the next part of the interview, Professor Beyer will discuss how they are going to use lasers to measure gravitational waves. It's an exciting research that has been going on for approximately 20 years, and they will finally be able to measure the gravitational waves using Professor Beyer's lasers in 2016.
So LIGO stands for Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. The goal of that experiment is to detect gravitational waves. And the tool that's used is a very precise laser. a laser that has a single frequency and extremely stable single frequency. I got involved in LIGO quite by accident. So sometimes doors open, sometimes doors close. And if a door opens and you step through, you might find something new. I was visiting the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics in Colorado. It's called JILA. And they do laser research as well and laser clocks and very impressive things. And when I was visiting, a good friend caught me in the hallway and said, "Oh, Beyer, I've been wanting to meet with you. Can you come down and look at my lab? We're thinking about a new idea about how to use lasers to do detection of gravitational waves." And that was Peter Bender. This is 1988. So in 88, I meet Peter Bender. He shows me a poster on the hall. And the poster on the hall has the sun here, the earth, the moon over here. And it has a big interferometer with a huge, big arm length, millions of kilometers in arm length. And he says, "I need a laser to make this interferometer." I said, "What do you want to make that for, Peter?" He said, "I want to detect gravitational waves. More particularly, I want to see gravitational waves from massive black holes that exist in the core of galaxies." At that time, we didn't know black holes were everywhere in the universe. We thought they were very few and far between. So he said, "I need a laser by 10 years from now, 1998, and I need it to be a 1-watt laser that can fly in a satellite. Do you think you can build it?" I said, "Yeah, I think we can do that. I think we have a good idea how to do that." Well, the 10 years that went by till 88, till 98, LISA experiment became LIGO, and LIGO became an NSF-sponsored ground-based antenna, not a space-based. So the laser that we were thinking about for the space-based gravitational wave antenna became the laser used in the ground-based antenna. So I have one of those early versions here. They're not very big and they're not very complicated. That's the top off of it. But it's a diode pump neodymium YAG laser, and it's got a little crystal right there. And that crystal is a ring crystal. The light goes in a ring path. And because of that and a little bit of magnetic field, that laser runs in a single frequency. Extremely precise single frequency. That became the heart of the laser that went into the LIGO ground-based interferometer. So we've been working with LIGO since 1992, formally sponsored by the National Science Foundation, and we contribute to aspects of building this instrument, and it's the most precise instrument ever built in the world by far. And we have yet to see gravitational waves. But we're upgrading LIGO, the first generation LIGO, to what we call advanced LIGO. And our team at Stanford is working on the contributions to that, to the suspension of the test masses, the optical coatings on the test masses, the laser that helps it work. And in 3 years' time, 2016 about, we should be turned on and operating at design sensitivity. And all the predictions from our astronomer friends are we will see gravitational waves. So we will open up a new window to the universe, looking at radiation that's emitted by massive objects, many times more massive than our sun, that co-orbit each other and radiate this radiation called gravitational radiation. The beauty about gravitational radiation is it's not absorbed, it's not scattered. So what you see is pure radiation from the sources. And if those sources happen to be in our own galaxy, two neutron stars orbiting, great, we have binary neutron stars in our own galaxy. But if it happens to be black holes at the edge of the known universe, right at the very beginning of time, we can detect those as well. So we'll have a window on the universe that's just unparalleled, precise window. And it will tell us a lot about what's going on in various parts of the universe that we cannot see with light radiation. So it's a very interesting experiment. It's been a long slog, but worth every minute of it because it's been an exciting goal to aim for.
I asked Professor Beyer how come it took more than 20 years to build one laser to measure the gravitational waves.
It's very hard. So we try to give examples that people can understand. The mirrors on the ground-based LIGO are 4 kilometers apart. 4 kilometers is the length of slack. And they're suspended by pendula so that they're isolated from ground vibration and ground motion. And we're actually measuring the position of the mirrors from one mirror to the other to less than the size of the nucleus of the atoms that make up the mirror. Not the atom size, but the nucleus size. So we're measuring to a part per billion of a wavelength. The wavelength of light is 1 micron. So divide that by a billion. That's how precise we're measuring the distance of these mirrors that make up the LIGO interferometer. And if we do that exactly right, then we will see gravitational waves propagate through our field of view. And those waves will apparently change the space itself. They don't move the mirrors. The mirrors stay perfectly the same. But space moves. Space-time moves. That's what a gravitational wave does. the closest analog is when you drop a pebble in a pond of water. The water doesn't move, but the waves propagate. But the water under the waves stays there and does a little circular thing like this. But the waves propagate. So gravitational waves are that. We don't drop a pebble in the pond. We drop a black hole binary system in a galaxy. And the waves propagate in space-time. That's what we're trying to measure. So it really is an exciting sort of field of research to do.
In the next segment, Professor Beyer will describe a very short history of laser applications. He will also tell us about some exciting new laser applications that he is working on.
We're living in a world that could not exist without a laser. So laser is only 52 years old. Every single bit of electronics that you touch today is made with a laser. The laser may help to trim the electronics, drill the vias in the circuit board, solder the circuit boards when they're all done. The laser cuts the glass on my favorite object, my iPhone. The iPhone has a very fine glass edge that has a perfect little corner on it, a rounded corner. Can't do it without a laser. Your computer, when it's manufactured, the chip, the computer actual chip that gets mounted with a laser. So in all of that area, lasers are a manufacturing tool that none of us ever see. But without it, you can't build these devices. So in that way, I call the laser the stealth utility. It's like electricity. It's a utility. We use it every day. We just don't know about it. Now, Tom Baird, our executive director of the Stanford Photonics Research Center, gave a nice talk where he said, what would happen if the laser stopped working? And the example we had actually occurred in South San Jose a few years ago when fiber optics got cut. They were digging trenches and somebody cut through a major fiber optic communication trunk. So all of the banks stopped working. All of the card transactions stopped working. You couldn't buy gasoline at gas stations. Televisions in the area stopped working. A whole set of things depend every day on optical communication through fibers. And those are driven by little lasers. And so when that got cut, all of the synchronization that allows all these things to happen went away. And until they repaired the fiber, it didn't come back. So the laser is virtually in every part of our lives, mainly medicine. We do a whole set of things in medicine that we would have never dreamed we could do. But we have a much more precise tool in the laser than we've ever had before. And the one we're working on now in our current research program is to use the laser to do breath analysis. The reason is that we now know from medical research that what you breathe out gives you a lot of indications of what your health is in your body. And we've known from ancient times that dogs could smell the breath of a person that had cancer, but we didn't know why. So now we can make that a quantitative way of making measurements. We can measure precisely the molecules that are in the breath, if it's ammonia or NO or other molecules. And from those molecules, it gives the physician then the hint at what they should look for in your health. Why is this important? Well, one of our friends works in the pediatric department. And he works with patients who can't speak, babies. And so Dr. David Stevenson is really quite interested in being able to assess the health of his patients, babies, using techniques that are non-invasive but can give him information that he can't get any other way.
Next, Professor Beyer will tell us how far along they are in finding lasers that can be used in breath analysis, and he'll also tell us a little bit about the history of using breath analysis in healthcare.
We've only been at that for 2 years now, so we're in the early phases, and the work has gone quite well, but we're a long way away from walking out of here with some product you could hold in your hand and use. What we're doing is the fundamental research in the laboratory that allows us to identify the molecules and show that we can do that quickly and routinely. And then eventually, if it has any legs, that idea will find its way out to some startup company or some larger medical company that turns it into a real useful product. That takes time. Breath analysis has been around. There was early work done by Professor Jun Ye at the University of Colorado in Gila. I've mentioned Gila once before. June is one of the highlights of that facility. So he's done some of the early published work. Dr. Konstantin Vodopianov here at Stanford has picked up and followed it with some work here at Stanford. And there's other work going on, so we're not unique, but we're contributing by trying to find a more reliable, less costly laser source that can allow it to happen so that it would be more useful to fit in a doctor's office. If you can do the analytical work by a computer in a doctor's office in real time, it means that that visit to a doctor can be much more productive.
Before leaving Professor Bayer, I wanted to know how many hours he worked per day to make all these inventions, and I also wanted to know what his typical teaching day at Stanford was like.
As long as I'm in my teaching and research mode, which I am most of the time, I haven't worked a day in my life. I love what I do. I'm here because I like the challenge of teaching students, and these are, of course, among the brightest students that you're going to meet anywhere, so they know much more than I do when we start the class environment. I'm here because we work with graduate students in a research environment and have the opportunity to contribute to knowledge in our research programs. And hopefully some of that knowledge becomes useful and might find applications in the world. Other knowledge is just understanding. You gain understanding, and when you do, and your student and you both make that breakthrough, it's always a moment you remember. In that sense, work is the wrong word. We spend time at what we do. And then a typical day during the teaching week, I usually start teaching at 8 in the morning. My students know this. The students grumble when they come into class. The graduate students in particular don't like coming to class at 8 in the morning. But I like to teach Tuesday and Thursday an hour and a half per course and take a break in between. My assistant, Vivian Drew, brings coffee in the morning for the 8 a.m. people that get there. I like the 8 a.m. because it's a good way to start the day. And for students, it's a good way for me to stay tuned on whether I'm teaching well.
Earlier this year at Stanford, there was a Bayer Festival. I asked Professor Bayer to tell us why this festival was held. I also wanted to know about Professor Bayer's hobbies, and I asked him how important it was to have a supportive family if one is to devote a lot of his time to study science.
One of the traditions in science, and it depends if you're in science or engineering, is you have a little show and tell. And so when I turned 70 this year, we had a Bayer Fest in September. And family members, of course, came and put together a one-day Saturday sort of presentation by people that had been former students, faculty, colleagues. Part of it at the end was a roast at dinner. All my children were there. My wife and I have three sons and a daughter, and now we have grandchildren. So my two youngest children decided they would be the one to give the roast speech, which they did. It was a lot of fun. So they had a good time. We're fortunate they live in the area, so we can see our grandchildren nearby. My youngest son and daughter both were Stanford graduates, and they told me in no uncertain terms would they become a scientist. They were going to go off and do other things. They did. The good news is I've had a supportive family. My wife has let me do science, which is more than an eight-hour-a-day job. So we've shared a lot of trips around the world to scientific meetings. We just got back from a trip to Australia. So on my computer screen is a photograph of the total eclipse of the sun, November 15th, in Port Douglas, Australia. So my wife and I traveled with our oldest son and daughter-in-law to Australia to see this event. Having a supportive family is crucial. Finding space and time for a family is something we've always done. And my old rule used to be when we went on family vacation, there was no science that followed us, no Stanford leftovers, no email, no faxes, and no phone calls. And my very first secretary here, Mary Farley, who was an English secretary, used to say, "Well, Professor Bayer, I will make sure they leave you alone." So we would go away for 4 weeks to Hawaii and have family vacation and do all the things families can have fun doing. And then I do astrophotography, which is my current hobby and been a hobby for a while. It's a hobby that's now growing and for finally beginning to involve the young people in it, because it involves computers and digital cameras and telescopes and tracking and a whole set of technical things, but also a fun way to look at the sky.
You've been listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Thank you for joining us today for our show about laser technology. We would like to thank our distinguished guest, Professor Robert Beyer, very much for his interview today, and we hope you can join us 2 weeks from today for Professor Beyer's second interview. In the upcoming interview, Professor Beyer will discuss his most recommended books on science and technology. We hope you can join us 2 weeks from today on Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. If you would like a copy of today's interview, please visit our website, moderntechnews.com. That's moderntechnews.com.